Hello and welcome to this audio commentary on Killer Joe, the 2011 movie directed by Billy Friedkin. My name's Rob Caravaggio, robcaravaggio.blogspot.com, and if you'd like to synchronize your copy of Killer Joe to this audio commentary, we'll give you a countdown in just a moment to help you do that. In the meantime, what you can do is locate the very start of the movie. We're watching a Region 1 DVD, and there is a Lionsgate logo that comes just before the start of the movie. There are some other production company and distributor logos that come after it. But we are watching the Region 1 DVD. There is a Blu-ray edition that has a kind of director's cut on it as well, in which Friedkin threw in some additional material and scenes. But he's got an audio commentary on there too. But we are watching the theatrical cut of Killer Joe, and that Lionsgate logo should be the first production company logo that you see. So as soon as that Lionsgate logo fades to black, hit pause on your DVD, Blu-ray, or what have you, and that will allow us momentarily to hit play together and watch the movie in perfect synchronized harmony. All right, if you have taken a moment to cue up to that Lionsgate logo, you should have it paused on an all-black screen just after that Lionsgate logo has faded to black. I'm going to say 3, 2, 1, play, and that'll be your cue to hit play with me, and let's watch a movie together. Ready? 3, 2, 1, play. Yeah, we've got some other, on the Region 1 DVD here, and I'm sure on the Blu-ray, we've got some other production company logos. There's LD Entertainment logo on the screen now, just faded away. And Voltage Pictures. That's kind of a cool one. I don't remember seeing that one when I saw this theatrically, saw it with an audience. Back when it came out, and perhaps the logo was different, or perhaps I just forgot. Anyway, very excited to be doing this movie. This is a movie that I like for a lot of reasons, and it kind of was overlooked, and in terms of the movies that came out this past year, sort of overlooked. McConaughey, I love the way it begins. I'll say something about this too. McConaughey sort of was great in Bernie, and he had Magic Mike, and so but this was the one where I thought he nailed it, and he sort of got attention for those other two movies that he'd made in 2012, or that came out in 2012. The cinematographer, I'll be saying a lot about him, is, there's a black cat going by. The cinematographer is, that black cat is just, those little touches that Friedkin throws in. I love those. The cinematographer is Caleb Dachanel, father of Zooey, but famous before she was ever famous as one of the great cinematographers. And this opening sequence with the car going by and the storm and the stormy sky above it, and then you have this Chris played by Emil Hirsch trying to wake up his. I guess, stepmother and Thomas Hayden Church's dad, while it's pouring rain out, and it looks like a horror film. I wrote in a sort of thing I wrote about the movie, kind of a quasi review. I mentioned that this is a lot like this opening of the movie. Not so much the interior here, where we're in Dottie's room. There's her foot on the screen. Of course, the great Juno Temple. Be saying a lot about her. I love how he's saying that he has to take a piss. A little snow globe there. Nice little touch, that snow globe. She suggesting, you know, maybe she's attracted to the idea of being locked in her own world. That dog barking. And there's our first shot of Gina Gershon and her crotch. Very brave performance by Gina Gershon. She got shit from some women's groups, and well, you know, I mean, they say what they're supposed to say, what you expect them to say, which is that this is not the most you know, her role and some of the things she does, it's not exactly a tract for feminism. It's not exactly the greatest moment in the history of feminism, but it is a brave performance by an actor that I always liked, Gina Gershon. She's still, you know, you get a sense for who these people are. You know, she's walking around naked below the waist, answering the door naked below the waist, and Thomas Hayden Church with the pajamas here. Anyway, that opening sequence with the storm outside and the dog barking, even the black cat that goes by as Chris pulls up in his car, that jalopy. It's, you know, Friedkin is a master of mood, and I wrote in that blog post I made reference to that sort of opening, it could have been in one of those old Universal monster movies from the 30s and early 40s, you know, the ones that Carl Freund did. I'm talking about the Dracula movies, the, you know, Boris Karloff playing Frankenstein, especially the Dracula movies, that sort of moody, gloomy opening or the that smack, the area around the castle. Or the place where Alucard lives, where Dracula lives. Just that very scary kind of moody thing. Friedkin really kind of does that at the beginning there. Also in the opening title sequence, as Gina Gershon sort of attacks Emil Hirsch here, you know, in that opening title sequence, Friedkin does what Francis Ford Coppola has always made a point of doing, and he's always said he's made a point of doing it, which is sort of honoring the writer in the credits. So it's Mario Puzo's The Godfather. And so in the opening titles, you saw William Friedkin's film of Tracy Letts's Killer Joe. I always think that's nice, you know, especially when it's a writer that people should know and be paying attention to. You know, when it's John Grisham's The Rainmaker, it's like, well, you know, Grisham is already doing pretty well, or Stephen King's The Mist. You know, I mean, I don't think that's what the title was of them. I think it was just The Mist that Darabont did. But, you know, it's just nice when you can get Letts is successful. He has a Pulitzer Prize, but many people don't know him, and I think he's very interesting if you read some of his work other than Killer Joe. So we have the, not so much the inciting incident, but opening up the film there, Chris reports to his family's trailer, and he's now explaining what the situation is that's going to get this plot rolling. And all this exposition really ultimately by the end of the movie doesn't matter. The whole thing with him and the money, it's sort of a quasi-MacGuffin. The whole thing with the money and his situation as a drug dealer, he owes this guy the money. We'll actually see the guy later on in what I think is a really nice, well-done chase sequence. But it's $6,000, and if he doesn't pay them, they're gonna harm him. All that stuff and Chris's situation, it sets up the characters here at the beginning, but it's just, you know, enough to get us to Killer Joe, enough to get us to McConaughey. Friedkin has always been very good at moving a story along, keeping things moving. And this is all just so that we can inch toward the appearance of Joe Cooper, played by McConaughey, as quickly as possible. This strip club, like most strip clubs, I like the blue here, the sort of hue that he gives it. It's sort of, it looks a lot like what the trailer looked like outside, that sort of, you know, thunderstorm kind of look, and those pathetic strings of lights, Christmas lights or holiday lights kind of that you see in gentlemen's clubs of this kind, the sort of lowbrow gentlemen's club. And so the explanation is pretty economical too. or the exposition where Emil Hirsch says, we won't find out that he's being duped until later, but this whole idea of the life insurance policy, $50,000, and he'll split the money with his dad, and the whole way these people relate to each other is really, it's funny, you know, this is a very funny movie, but it gives us a real sense for what this family is like. The whole idea of trailer trash, and some people didn't like the movie because of the way it depicted quote-unquote white trash, but I think it has a lot of respect for this kind of subculture or these kinds of people. I just think, the you know, these people aren't amoral and wretched people because they're quote-unquote white trash. That's a nice reveal there as the camera tilts up. Cameras don't pan up or down, they tilt up or down. It's an interesting family. These are bad people, ultimately. I mean, we have to have some kind of empathy for them, but these are bad people ultimately because of what they're doing and the fact that they, you know, are going to engage, you know, they're going to, you know, Killer Joe's not the bad guy. They're all kind of immoral, with the exception perhaps of Dottie, but we'll get into her character as the movie does. Thomas Hayden Church really impressed me in this movie. He of course, you know, had been on people's radar because of Wings, the TV show, but then Sideways, he sort of broke back and broke back into the sort of Hollywood radar, and then he took some roles that he was in that movie All About Steve. He took some roles that were just kind of not interesting, and it seemed like people just wanted to put him in movies. But I think he really gets this character here. There's the dog again, signaling to us that we're coming back to the trailer. I'm going to be saying a lot about Billy Friedkin, and Billy as he prefers to be called. He is, you know, when I in that blog post of mine, I wrote that he is, you know, old school in all the right ways. He's, I believe, in his 70s now, and I wasn't so big on Bug. There's Dottie. I wasn't so big on Bug, the previous movie he'd made in collaboration with Tracy Letts, based on Letts's work. But this I was really big. It's just, you know, this was, of course, an NC-17 movie, and he's still, you know, if you're not familiar so much with Friedkin, he's The French Connection, The Exorcist. This is a very careful filmmaker who has always, he was deeply, deeply influenced by, he's sort of like Peter Bogdanovich in a way. They have very different sort of personalities. And if you've ever seen Friedkin talk or interviewed, he's just a fascinating guy. He's older. He's still got his wits about him. He sounds exactly the way he sounded when he was 50 and when he was 30. You know, he just has this constant sort of personality to him. And he was deeply influenced by, like Bogdanovich, this is the point I was making about Bogdanovich, deeply, deeply influenced by Orson Welles and the sort of studio era of the, say, the late 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and even the 60s. You know, Welles was working sort of hopscotching in and out of that studio system. But Fritz Lang, Douglas Sirk, these sort of Samuel Fuller, Arthur Penn, these really sharp, as in intelligent Hollywood directors. I'm going to get into some scene-specific analysis here, but I just want to talk about Billy Friedkin for a while. He was deeply influenced by that Hollywood era, as so many directors are. You know, Tarantino was influenced by the same sort of things, same sort of directors. But as Juno Temple disrobes there, almost, it cuts away. There she is. The brave performance by Juno. She was, of course, in The Dark Knight Rises, too. But Friedkin really learned well from watching those movies, and he's a great sort of critic of his own work. If you hear him talk about his movies and what he's trying to accomplish. And so it was just nice. The point here is this is a nice sort of gradual reveal of our title character. And of course, the dog does not bark at Killer Joe, sensing, you know, perhaps that he's met his match in terms of ferocity. It's, you know, we have a sense that somehow we'll get into Dottie's head. There's this, you know, suppressed, you see it here, this sort of kind of suppressed aggression that the Dottie character has. Or we won't get into her head as much as sort of this suggests. Temple's performance allows us to read into it, but the film doesn't tell us outright everything that's going on with her, which is why it's sort of a cool character. I think that TV is a little too nice for this trailer. It's a double wide, looks like, but I don't know. You'd think this would look... It's actually kind of nice in there. You'd think it would be more of like a Raising Arizona thing. But there's McConaughey. But anyway, Friedkin is just... it was sort of like Scorsese, you know, just as much a cinema lover as he is a producer of great cinema, a crafter of great cinema. And I think that, if you are interested in Fritz Lang or Billy Friedkin, or just interested in hearing cool things about movies, if you go to YouTube, this is on YouTube, last I checked, there is a series of videos that they probably scrunched them all onto one video by now, but there's a series of videos from the 70s in which they're in black and white. She is a little peach, isn't she, Juno Temple? Yeah, I mean, they really do a good job of making her look sexy as hell, but also childlike, innocent, you know. The sort of we get duped and fooled about her the way some of the characters do. You know, we think that she's one thing and she's really much more. But there's a series of videos or video in which Billy Friedkin in the 1970s interviewed Fritz Lang, interviewed him about Lang's work, about Lang's. And it's sort of like the Howard Hawks interviews and Orson Welles interviews that Bogdanovich did. Speaking of Bogdanovich, you know, he just kind of goes into shit with Fritz Lang. And it's fascinating, too. You hear how Lang actually got out of Germany just as the Nazi Party was strengthening its vice grip on the society, and he tells that story, and he talks about his sort of approach to movies. And so that's just a really it's just candy to movie lovers. I recommend that to you. Maybe I always say I'm going to put a link when we post these commentaries, but I'm sure I'll forget here. Love the way Juno Temple sits on that chair with the knees like that. You can see she's taken with Joe right away, and Joe with her. But the I hate that word chemistry, but the for lack of a better word, the chemistry between these two is, I think, right for the source material. The play Killer Joe, I have not seen a production or footage of when it was in production, but I think it was Scott Glenn who played Killer Joe at one point on the stage, and from what I understand, it was a lot more disturbing, not so much the imagery that we see in the movie, but disturbing in terms of the interaction between Joe here and Dottie. Friedkin liked McConaughey for the role because McConaughey has been in our consciousness as moviegoers. I love the story he tells her, the genitals set on fire. I mean, this is one of those stories that sort of more egotistical cops like to tell civilians. I think I've said this before in a commentary, nothing against police. I'm just saying that, you know, in every profession, especially ones that have, perhaps an element of danger to them, you have cops you have people who like to regale others and shock others with stories of how, fucked up their job can be. And, McConaughey is just very good here. You know, in Bernie, which a movie that also came out the year this did, and last year, and also in Magic Mike. He was very good in both of them. I thought in Bernie he was kind of mugging, and the way he portrayed the character was a little bit out of step with the way the other actors were. He's almost like he wasn't on their wavelength. It seemed like Jack Black was, even in the zanier moments, was sort of playing it straight, and certainly Shirley MacLaine was. But his performance was the one that stuck out as sort of odd to me in that movie. And in Magic Mike, I thought he was perfect because the role calls for somebody. I mean, that when you read that on the page, that screenplay, I'm sure you think of McConaughey. You know, we got to get McConaughey. You know, I mean, just the fact that the whole cowboy hat thing. I mean, and I thought he did exactly what you'd expect him to do in that role, but he was interesting. In it, he did interesting and surprising things too. Here, this is a much more restrained McConaughey. This is someone who knows he's the star of the movie, who knows that he's also the villain. And there's the big question: are you going to kill my mom? It's the first hint we have, other than the kung fu in front of the television. It's the first hint we have that Dottie is cognizant of things that others might not think she... I mean, it's people who are like this who look even more youthful than they are, and she is, I believe the character is supposed to be 20 or something like that. People in real life, you know, people are able to, just through their behavior, able to have an effect, especially women on men, have an ability to affect them in a way that makes them think that the person has a mentality of someone much younger. It's funny how the plot functions here. This whole thing, we hear that the mother tried to kill Dottie when she was a baby. Dottie remembers it. There's this whole weird relationship between Chris and Dottie. He obviously loves his sister, but just what kind of love and what's going on there and what that dream was about is something that never gets fully articulated in the movie, but it is quasi-romantic. And like the word interesting, I seem to be using the word quasi a lot today. Sorry for that. I love this location here. I don't know if they dress this painted that billiards thing on there or what, but and so-called billiard room, I don't know if that's exterior. I think we have a shot that shows that the exterior we just saw is actually connected to this interior, but you know, for a pool room, this doesn't look like it has very many tables. And that's a bar box table there. That's I think a 3x5, it's like a 3.5x8 is the table dimensions, and standard pool tables that you would expect to see in a pool room, a big pool room, are going to be 4.5x9. But I think we covered that in the Color of Money commentary, the mechanics of pool tables. Now, it's funny how this movie is cut together. The whole first encounter with Dottie, you know, it's important to the plot that he meets Dottie before he actually meets the guys who are hiring him to assassinate the mother, Thomas Hayden Church's ex-wife, Emil Hirsch's mother. McConaughey's very, very good here. Just very calm, very restrained. And it's sort of like, you know, McConaughey at his worst is in a scene like this would not be trusting the other actors in these reaction shots like this one of Hirsch and of Hayden Church, and the tone of the overall scene when it's directed right and cut together. He in other movies has not been as trusting that the other actors would actually sell his performance and the way they react to it. But here, you know, even the way he's shot from the slightly low angle just there, I mean, it seems like McConaughey is trusting the other actors and trusting the tone that Friedkin is creating to make him seem as menacing as the character is supposed to be. So he's not trying to be, he's actually, you know, speaking in this even tone of voice. He's speaking very matter-of-factly, because to him it's right for the character. It is matter-of-factly. This is Joe, of course, is a cop who is does this kind of murder for hire on the side. And here we have it's kind of a weird dialogue thing in the movie, because Emil Hirsch is telling Joe what the audience already knows about the insurance policy. Now, see, even this here, you know, McConaughey is very, very relaxed, and he's, you know, and it's the costuming too. He's all in black. He's allowing Emil Hirsch's performance and the overall tone of the scene to really give the character that frightening thing. And his first encounter of Dottie was kind of disturbing too, just because, you know, you can already see him eyeballing her. We have a nice shot coming up here. I think that was on one of the lobby card posters. Juno Temple was a big discovery for me in this film too. I just thought she was great, and I thought that a lot of actors her age are not going to be able to. I mean, just even that shit she's doing with the dancing and the kung fu. I mean, apparently she's British too. Just are not going to be able to pull this off and have it be so right for the material. I think this is a good situation. It's sort of like in The Social Network, where you have a screenwriter and a director, and the actors all kind of are clearly on the same wavelength. They're all trying. They all know what this material is, and they all seem hip to it, and they're all sort of playing the characters just right. I love that Thomas Hayden Church, the father, does not catch on. Just how stupid are you? Emil Hirsch asks him. Again, reinforcing the fact that Thomas Hayden Church is stupid, and Emil Hirsch is just slightly smarter, smart enough to know that what Joe has just made reference to is that he's going to, in case you need a refresher on the plot, they can't front Joe the money until their mother, or Emil Hirsch's mother and the ex-wife of Thomas Hayden Church, is dead, and they can collect the insurance money. They're not going to be able to pay him until, it's sort of like in Boogie Nights, where Mark Wahlberg and Reed Rothschild are saying, look, I can't, and there's the pictures. That's a nice setup and for a payoff that comes later. She's talking to her, the person she's having an affair with. They can't, it's sort of like in Boogie Nights, where it's like, we can't pay for our studio time until we get a record contract, and then they'll pay us millions of dollars, you know. It's just ridiculous, but it's the same sort of thing here. They can't pay Joe for killing, the mother, until she's dead. So as a retainer, Joe teaches them the word retainer. He's going to take the lovely and seemingly innocent Dottie, and it is funny and that Thomas Hayden Church doesn't catch on to what Joe means by that. He needs it explained to him. Hey, you see Juno Temple, the way she relates to Sharla here, played by Gershon. If you just watch the movie and watch Juno Temple, watch the way when she interacts with different characters, how she... you notice that this guy says, I didn't want black olives, but Gershon put, it looks like she, I'm not sure, man, you'd have to rewind it. I think she put those black olives on while Juno Temple was sort of bugging her now. But the way Juno Temple talks alternates between, you see the way she's resting on her chin here, it's sort of kind of youthful in a way, but also the way she's talking, the intensity in her eyes, the things she's saying, the way she moves from one thought to another, very adult-like. So again, her performance is hinting us, is cluing us in at just who Dottie is, and that she's not oblivious, and in fact, she knows more than anyone thinks she knows. Yeah, I too, apparently Friedkin was too, on the special features he talks about it. I was shocked to hear she's British. We've gone this far. Not Gershon, that Juno Temple is British. She has that small part in The Dark Knight Rises where she's Anne Hathaway's roommate. Doesn't really have much to do. Perhaps she had other scenes that were cut. But she's one. She's like Jennifer Lawrence, you know. It just seems to me, having seen her in this Juno Temple, that she, Jennifer Lawrence is that young. She's 22 or something, and she could play someone 10 years older and sell it, and she could play someone her age and sell it. It just seems to be that age as an actress is. And to be that sort of lovely is actually kind of a difficult thing to navigate the parts that are offered to you and make right choices, make, you know, sensible choices, choices that can really show that you can act. And, you know, I think Jennifer Lawrence has done a reasonably good job, but she just seems really, really to have a nice intellect. This is some kind of fucking basement here on this pizza joint. Now, this is interesting because it shows that Gershon is not really hip or has failed to notice the underlying smarts and sophistication of Sharla, is Gershon's character's name. She's failed to notice the sophistication of Juno Temple's character. They make a kind of a funny couple, you know, these two actors. Because they're both sort of good-looking, and so it's believable that they'd be married, but also they are very good at playing trashy, if that makes any sense. And she's naked there again. I mean, this is a very brave performance for a young actress. To be naked in a movie is, I know a couple actors and who've had to be like naked in movies that, you know, very few people saw and, you know, but to be naked in a movie that a lot of people see is something. He's watching Monster Trucks. Now, what I was going to say is that we've gone this far, haven't even said a thing about the NC-17 rating that this movie has. Or I think it was, now my little Netflix sleeve here says not rated, but I believe the MPAA gave it an NC-17. And on the Wikipedia page for the film, it has a nice little section on it. And I want to read just a very short little thing that Friedkin said about the NC-17. And because if you haven't seen Kirby Dick's documentary, this film is not yet rated, about how the ratings board works and how kind of they give you an initial preliminary rating and then you're allowed to recut your film in order to make it conform or to a different rating or to get a lower rating. She has Joseph Gordon-Levitt and she has Justin Bieber on her door, but she has this really outdated picture of Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I mean, that picture of Joseph Gordon-Levitt is got to be a decade old because I don't believe he's had hair like that for a good number of years. Again, we see the dynamic in the family. The protector of Dottie, or the person who assumes the protector role, is Chris. The father is, you know, he's kind of policing his own father here. I like that shot here with Joe out the door, and the baseball cap versus Joe's very menacing cowboy hat, you know. He says, "That's right, Junior, don't push it." I mean, he there's a precision. Maybe it's because it was based on a play and everybody involved in this movie wanted to have fidelity to Tracy Letts's words. But there's a precision of language that McConaughey has in his line readings that is so right for the character, and that I don't see a lot from him in some other movies. He sort of, at various times, has been cited as someone who, not improv, but someone who is a little loose with the line readings. Or maybe that was just in a couple movies that I read about, but I've definitely noticed that he's very, you know, it's right for the character. Again, he's very particular in the way he's saying things. The yellow Corvette, unmistakable, of course. And we see that Sharla, what we already know, that she is carrying on an affair. Thing that William Friedkin said about the, ultimately they didn't revise the film, they accepted their NC-17 rating. The film premiered at first outside the country in Venice, at the Venice Film Festival, then I think it went to Toronto. I actually caught it at South by Southwest. But here's what Billy Friedkin said about just the rating controversy. And this is under the section rating controversy on the Wikipedia page for the Killer Joe film. William Friedkin, quote, "Cutting would not have made it mass appeal. Cutting it would have been the equivalent of what members of the United States government and military leaders said about the Vietnam War. They said, we have to destroy Vietnam in order to save it. And that's what I would have done to Killer Joe. To get an R rating, Friedkin says, I would have had to destroy it in order to save it, and I wasn't interested in doing that." Now, Friedkin, that's kind of a tad melodramatic, maybe, but I think it speaks to Friedkin's kind of sensibility and his approach to making movies, and sort of why I really like him. I mean, this thing about censoring his movies and his movies having sort of extreme content has, you know, he's had this, it's been an issue with his movies since the beginning, since the 70s. But I think what that reflects is he says, we would have had to destroy it to save it. And of course he collaborated close with Tracy Letts, the playwright. He really understands that the, what I was happy to see that a lot of reviewers got when this movie came out, what they understood is that the extreme content, which isn't all that extreme, but the sort of simulated sex between McConaughey and that sort of simulated sex scene between McConaughey and Killer Juno Temple, that sort of chicken wing or drumstick fellatio thing that happens at the end, spoiler, that stuff really needs to be in the story. I mean, it is so integral to understanding how ugly some of these characters really are and how fucked up this world really is. You get it from the fact, I mean, we see so many murder for hire movies and people trying to kill other people for base or selfish reasons. We see that so much in movies that we kind of, our mind glosses over it. But here, you know, the perversity of Joe and the warped mind of, and the ugliness of the moral compass, the moral compass of these people that always seems to point toward ugly. you really do need to see that stuff and see it for as long as we see it, especially at the end. Otherwise, you don't really get it. I really do think that our mind glosses over murder in movies just because we're so used to it. This has been called a neo-noir, and certainly there are, I mean, she's an unlikely femme fatale Juno Temple, holding her own in this scene with McConaughey. Blowing him out of the water, really, in a lot of respects. You know, see the way she looks at him there. She's manipulating him the whole time, and we gradually come to understand that in the mac and cheese. Tuna casserole, that's right. Looks like macaroni and cheese. You see Joe is very mannerly. All of this stuff at the table, too, is sort of a visual foreshadowing of the dinner scene at the end. Hey, see, that's not appropriate dinner conversation, he says. This is when I say McConaughey gets the role right, this is what he gets exactly right. This, you see how calm he is. Again, I'm struck by the calmness and the it's the opposite of chewing the scenery. He's simply chewing his food here, you know. She asked him a question there and he just answered yes. He didn't really try to act out the yes. He just answered as, you know, I think he really embodies this horrible character. In a way that we haven't, that I wish we'd see more. I've been a McConaughey supporter for such a long time. You know, I think even when he's sort of over the top or bad in something, he's still kind of good. I actually prefer him to someone like Matt Damon, who is I actually don't think Matt Damon has the kind of range that a McConaughey has. Not that he's given much opportunity to demonstrate that range. Now this slow build up here where he places the chair, all Joe's movements are very precise. You know, the way he's, that's not proper dinner conversation. The way he, even the way he fidgets with that lighter, that Zippo lighter with the police star on it, I think, even the way he fidgets kind of has this, this rehearsed precision to it that, you know, it seems to have been very calculated by, McConaughey. I think he put a lot of thought into what he's doing here. And, whereas in a movie like Magic Mike, he's not the star of it. I mean, he's a supporting actor in that movie, but in a movie like Magic Mike, I mean, I think he's just kind of riffing and, not that, I mean, there's lines written for him, obviously, but I think he's just kind of, being zany and kind of going for, you know, 10 decibels every time. And it's kind of easy for someone like him to do that. But here, I always felt that he's really cerebral. If you go back and watch some of his early roles. But Contact with Jodie Foster. He plays her sort of love interest, this sort of holy roller love interest of Jodie Foster. And if you watch him in that movie, he's actually, you know, I like it. I like what he's doing there. I kind of see, you know, stuff going on behind the eyes, and it's not just the milquetoast McConaughey that we get in so many of those romantic comedies with Kate Hudson. And so Friedkin here putting us behind Killer Joe as Dottie. He forces Dottie to disrobe, and I mean, this is really how to say it. I mean, this is really making us. You notice the photography here. Killer Joe is sort of silhouetted, and not silhouetted, but sort of has blue painted on him, blue light. The light that's outside those windows there, and Dottie is in that sort of raw, brighter light. Nice touches all around here. But when he was sitting down, Friedkin sort of had the camera behind him, and it allows us to kind of have his point of view and appreciate, you know, from that vantage point, kind of appreciate how sick he is, how perverted, and how serious he is about this. You know, this isn't a joke to him. This is lovemaking as far as Killer Joe is concerned. Do I think the movie deserved an NC-17? Well, I think the ratings board is, the MPAA is even more moronic than they seem. No, I've seen movies with an R rating that had much more graphic sex. I think it's the age of, I didn't read their actual, you can actually, there's a website where you can actually read what the MPAA, how they described a certain movie, and it was probably the age of the Juno Temple character relative to Joe's age, and it was probably the perverted, quote-unquote, or I would say kink, the kinkiness of this scene, and, you know, because when you think about the chicken scene, the one on this DVD, there's this special feature where they have a Q&A session at South by Southwest, which I didn't stay for, but all the questions that the guy was in a wheelchair. He seemed like a nice enough guy, but he was sort of an idiot. He kept asking about that chicken scene as if that was what the point of the movie was. And, you know, I think that when you think about it, someone just sucking on a piece of chicken, simulating oral sex, it's really not as, graphic as, some sex scenes that I've seen in R-rated movies that came out the same year. And it's the fact that Dottie's face here, you know, Dottie's face and, you know, she seems to be, at least on the surface and enjoying or into what's going on. And so these are the things that the ratings board, focus on. Bunch of dimwits. But yeah, I mean, that's a death kiss of death, the NC-17. You're just not going to be seen by as many people, and you're not going to have your movie promoted and advertised as much as it could be. There's our black cat again, as Emil Hirsch looks in the trailer. Kind of a Dutch angle there. That's kind of weird. Don't see a lot of that in Friedkin. And then, I don't know what that Dutch angle was about. Dutching is tilting the camera so the image is slightly on a diagonal angle or on some kind of a diagonal angle. That actually looks like a nice OTB that he's at here. The OTBs that I've seen aren't this sleek. Oh, I was gonna mention Caleb Dachanel right at the beginning, and I never did. Great cinematographer, and saw him speak once at a film school where I just sort of popped in because they were having different cinematographers speak at some sort of convention. Pardon me. And it seems like a very nice guy, and I really like sort of what he does with contrast. Not so much within a shot, but the way he lit that opening sequence of the movie, for example, here, versus the way he lit some of the interiors that are much more bright, and so you have this. You see it in some of his other movies that he's been DP on. The same kind of lighting reoccurring around different characters, but in really subtle ways. So I think he's really great. This chase sequence, by the way, of course, one of the great chase sequences ever. The French Connection was Billy Friedkin. You know, for a director as old as he is, I mean, I was thrilled when I saw this. This is, you know, and he doesn't do that Fast and the Furious thing where it's, we're cutting too much. Cut. Nice use of locations here. It's pitch black inside this edifice, this brick building here, and then they roll out. You know, you don't have all that rapid cutting. We have this, it's kind of an elaborate chase sequence. You've got one guy on foot, two guys on motorcycles, and then we're going to have this truck or SUV pop in. And like this little moment here against the wall, and it shows us the feet of the guys creeping up on him. I mean, this is so much better than directors today who their bread and butter is action sequences and chase sequences. And he keeps us in wide shot here as, he's cutting above here to this crane shot from above. Lets us see that there's even graffiti on the ground, but this is kind of has a West Side Story feel to it, doesn't it? But the way they circle around and he keeps us back in wide shot as opposed to cutting in for a close up on Emil Hirsch or something, so much better than some of these Fast and Furious movies. You know, it allows you to really see the performance, see the chase, see the stunt work that's going on. Or the mild stunt work in this case. Now, this is one of my favorite scenes in the movie here, following the chase, is with this guy that he owes the money to. It's kind of like, if you've ever lived in the South, I have. It's this Southern hospitality, even when someone is fucking you over or has to give you bad news or kind of is upset with you. This guy's making small talk, and the fact is he's into this guy for like six large, and in a moment here he's gonna say I forgot the henchmen's names here, but I like their performances, but I forgot the names of the characters, but he's gonna say Mike and Jim here are gonna beat the fuck out of you now. Just we'll catch you later, you know. Let me see if I can look at the mustachioed man who plays this is it the name of the actor? I think Mark McCauley. I believe it's Mark McCauley. That's exactly the kind of vehicle this local guy would be. This local tough guy, local loan shark or whatever, would be riding in the South in Texas. You know, big red Dodge Ram. Yeah, see how he keeps us in wide shot here? Yeah. And then we cut in. When we do cut in, it's to appreciate the amount of blood. And now this is really good makeup and blood work. I heard a makeup person call fake blood on someone's face when they're beaten up in a movie blood work. Trash can on fire back there. But that's also what they call it when you get blood tested, like at a hospital or something. Hey, that blood work come back. It's funny, but this is great. So now Charlotte is getting a little bit of taste of her own medicine here. Getting to have to deal with someone else walking around naked in her living room. And we get a sense for, just the fact that they're okay. Thomas Hayden Church is okay with Joe banging his daughter in the house. And Joe, it's kind of a trope in movies, but it's true, I guess, in real life. But Joe says, if they were going to kill him, they'd have killed him. I love the he owes me $10 line that Thomas Hayden Church has there. And they're sort of they sort of greet their son coming home like this with equanimity, you know. Of course, Dottie is frantic about it, but they say, oh, well, we're going to turn it. You know, I never know when a movie makes the same point over and over again, it's important that it makes the same point in different ways. And the fact that these people really don't seem to have the proper concern for each other as family members, or perhaps this kind of stuff is so routine. Now, the blood work or the blood makeup he had before was really, I mentioned a moment ago how impressed I was by it. This bruise work, I guess you could call it, this bruising, this black and blue stuff, you're going to have a close-up on it when they have the funeral scene. Not so much. Doesn't look as real. I think the black eyes or the black and blue marks under his eyes are maybe a little too symmetrical. Or haven't said anything about Emil Hirsch. I think he's really... I did like Into the Wild. I liked him in Milk, too. He's one of those like young actors like Leo DiCaprio early on in Leo DiCaprio's career, where it just seems like the parts that he gets offered are often the same kind, or that he gets are often the same kind of parts, and for sort of a fresh-faced pretty boy kind of thing. And I like that he's sort of made a point of not playing against type, but just you know, nabbing some part. Into the Wild was one, you know, just nabbing some parts that are really allow him to do different things. I'll get on my rant again about sunglasses in movies. In a previous commentary that we're going to be releasing about Dr. Strangelove, I pointed out that what a lot of people have pointed out, that Peter Sellers, when he plays the Strangelove character, Peter Sellers wears sunglasses that are actually not fully translucent. They're slightly transparent. They're still tinted, but you can see his eyes, so you can see the performance. And you know, it's true to the character that Killer Joe would have those aviator, because he's a cop, have those aviator glasses on with the mirror finish. But... you know, you can't see the performance when you can't see the eyes. I always wish they would tint them a different way so that we can see the performance. And this is kind of an important little sequence here where we get to see that Joe, we know he's a cop, but we get to see that he really is a cop and that he sort of has a daily grind to this stuff too. We see him greet that other police officer and this sort of dressing to do battle or dressing to go out is you know, a little bit precious, but I think it was just so that we could see him in the station, I think. Now, this is really I'll talk about the film noir elements and why people have labeled it a neo-noir, or what did they label it here on? They labeled it a Southern Gothic dark comedy neo-noir. Someone labeled it online. I don't know about all that. I mean, but this idea of you plotted to kill somebody or you plotted to commit a robbery or something, and, you can't call it off. It's too late. This idea that you've already started the launch sequence, so after, you know, you can't call. I mean, in real life, people. I mean, you could call it off. I mean, a hitman, if it's a couple hours before he's actually going to kill the person for you, I'm sure the hitman would say, "Look, just all right. If you don't want it to go down, it won't go down. But you got to pay me something for the." You know, not the full amount, but part of the amount for the trouble or something. But in movies, of course, it works, because it creates that character moment for Emil Hirsch, and of course that lightning, harkening back to the beginning of the movie. that foreboding as we're about to. And then the three crosses there, perhaps indicating the three, I won't spoil the end of the movie anymore, although you should see the movie before you listen to this. Not enough strip malls in movies and strip mall-looking places. I'm glad this place, it seems to be one restaurant. I'm glad this place looks like a strip mall. Well, there are certain noir elements. I mean, the big one is like the double indemnity thing of kill this person, help me kill this person so we can get the insurance money. And that's the one of the few times you see her body. I like that you don't see the kill. You see the aftermath. You know, violence in movies is, I have no problem with violence as such. My problem with a lot of times is that it's just not imaginative as it could be. You see people getting killed, but it's sort of more interesting the way Friedkin does it here, is that you see the aftermath and it becomes a reveal. You see Joe, you know, Joe was totally cool on the ride over. He was totally calm. This is routine stuff. He was talking to Emil, the Chris character, Emil Hirsch. And yet, he'd already done the deed, you know. Using his lighter there. And I like, it's a nice kill because you don't see it, but I like that you see how Joe, you know, this sort of how-to that you get of how Joe disposes of the body, how he knows to put alcohol on her, and how he knows to torch the car in the proper way. It's very, very, much more interesting than just seeing someone shot in the head for the zillionth time in a movie. Now, this is kind of weird that he torches it that way because it's cinematic, but I would think as a matter of forensics, when the crime scene investigators get there, they'll see that that gasoline or whatever that flammable liquid was that he uses to torch the car. This is well-timed, this effect here. Yeah. You don't actually see it blow, you don't actually see it get engulfed in flames. You see the light hitting Emil Hirsch's face, cuts back, the car's inflamed, then it blows. Very, very cool. Again, Friedkin not showing this, you know, not showing a key part and then showing, not showing a key image and then showing it a different way, showing that light on his face. Now the way Adati sort of argues with him here is, again, that looked like Dame Judi Dench, that extra sitting at the table. The way she argues with him here is again, youthful yet adult-like. Now, this is what I was talking about with Caleb Dachanel, too. Well, the scene just cut away. But that was a very brightly lit scene in the diner there. And this is kind of a medium brightly lit scene here. And you have those intensely dark scenes. And the movie kind of skips between them. So it's very, very cool. The other noir tropes, or characteristics, sure. The big one is killing someone for the insurance money or killing someone for a selfish reason, and then that plot somehow going awry or hiring someone to do it. But it depends on who you see as the main protagonist of the movie. I mean, Emil Hirsch is the one whose plight we're introduced to first, and this family is kind of one big protagonist, each with all different motives. But I don't think it's the femme fatale. I would not call Juno Temple a femme fatale. I think definitely the idea of someone who's already in trouble, if you take the protagonist as Emil Hirsch, the idea of someone who's already in trouble, like the Chris character, trying to rectify or get out of his trouble, and then just sliding deeper and deeper, you know, his problems just snow, as he tries to fix his problems, as he or she tries to fix his problems, usually a he in film noir, it just snowballs and he creates more problems for himself or even exacerbates his problems. Now they're starting to figure it out, but it'll be another scene where Thomas Hayden Church finally, who's the one who told you about Killer Joe? And this idea of, and the idea of being duped in this way, too. The idea of being duped into doing someone else's dirty work, I guess, is a little bit of a noir thing. But the first time I saw the movie, I didn't think noir. I thought more sort of tragicomic farce with, you know, I thought, you know, I mean, this is a movie in terms of just the general plot. I mean, this is something the Coen brothers could have made. Yeah, I mean, this is outdoor photography. It's obviously bright out, so they're tamping down some of the light, but it helps that Thomas Hayden Church is wearing a visor there, a hat, so that it shades his face. But I think the way they... So when you're outdoors like this in a location, you're trying to harness and direct light and block light from certain angles, not so much as light things artificially, but trying to orchestrate actors' movements and block out light from certain angles so that you can create what you could create under more control, something like what you might create if the actual light source were more controllable. All you can do is decrease it when it's light out. Now, I've always liked the way Caleb Deschanel does that. I mean, it's sort of cinematography 101 in terms that he should be able to do that well as a cinematographer, but he seems to embrace more of that bright light than try to block out huge amounts of it like you sometimes see on television shows do that more than movies, I guess, where they're blocking out what I feel might be too much light. But, of course, people are seeing those on smaller screens. What did Caleb Deschanel do? Well, he did his wife, and we got Zooey Deschanel, so... Jesus. He did a Hal Ashby movie I like, being there. He did The Black Stallion. He did... here, let me just pull up his IMDb. Apologize. Oh, gosh, that's right. He did some stuff with Mel Gibson. He did The Patriot and The Passion of the Christ. The Passion of the Christ would be an interesting movie to do because I actually am... I'm bigger on that movie and what it's doing. As an atheist who is not at all religious, I was sort of, just as pure filmmaking, all the, what came out later about the anti-Semitism of Gibson and, the more unflattering, motivations he might have had, I really, sort of like The Passion. And one of the reasons I like it is because of the sort of look that Gibson and Deschanel gave it. I think it's, the whole torture porn accusation, I think, misses the point. Again, not at all religious, but I the point of that story from the point of view of the people who made it was that this torturing and this suffering that the character Jesus goes through has a point. And why am I talking about The Passion while Killer Joe's on? But, Deschanel. There's a good shot. As Dottie turns around, you see she's got a slight shadow on her face, but she's brightly lit all around. So, I mean, the actor has to hit their mark there, but that they've, you can see that we're in Texas and it's really sunny out, but you can still get shadows under the eyes of the characters, shadows on, on those key points on the face, below the chin, like Dottie in the back seat here. But you can still see how blazing hot, they're wearing jackets, but you can say it's still sunny in Texas, so. What do I think of the relationship between Dottie and Chris? I think it's purposely meant to be as weird as it is. I don't know that there's a real answer in sort of what went down there. It's sort of like when we did the movie Shame, the relationship between the Carrie Mulligan character and let me just get some coffee here. Pardon me. The relationship between the Carrie Mulligan character and the Brandon character the Michael Fassbender character in Shame. I don't think we're supposed to piece together exactly what went down between the brother and sister there or exactly how they view each other. We're just supposed to kind of, I think, get that it's weird, that it's highly weird, highly irregular. And to some extent that it's very different in Shame, but here I think, and to some extent it's mutual, like this affection, this attachment they have to each other is genuine and something that they don't feel much shame about. There's a little foreshadowing, with the dog not barking at Dottie, didn't bark at Joe, didn't bark at Dottie. They'll both be executioners. I like Matthew McConaughey in that very funny HBO show Eastbound and Down where he... you knew I was going to mention it, right? Speaking of my friend here, Eastbound and Down, where he plays this scout, this baseball scout, who gets involved in the career of Kenny Powers, and he has some just outrageous lines, and he was the perfect guy to get for it. There's some more thunder again. It's almost like, to separate, the acts, we're now into kind of the home stretch here, act three, and, maybe that's how, Friedkin is using it. The K Fry C, that's what, when I left the screening, I went to the public screening. That's what everybody was saying. I got you some K-Fry-C. Now, they've got Bush beer in the fridge and Budweiser. believe that I would have to go for the Budweiser. Bush beer does not taste good. But it costs 99 cents, so you see why people get it. Now, the lighting here recalls the opening of the picture, right? She just flicked on the light. But that Joe in silhouette, the blueness, that sort of universal horror movie lighting. Gina Gershon has always been, you know, she's going to have her big moments here. She still looks good, doesn't she? Still looks sexy. Apparently she was offered to be in the stage production. She was, they approached her to be in the stage production when this was off Broadway years ago. And she, I think I saw the interview where she says she wasn't ready. Basically, she more or less says she wasn't ready to, you know, suck on a chicken wing for two shows a day for however long the off-Broadway run of the production would be. But I think she's, you know, it seems like an odd compliment to say that she's good at, but I mean, the point of that is that she's terrified and that this is a, to some extent she's getting her comeuppance, but everybody kind of does here. And this is, and it's a comeuppance that begins because she is under the delusion that she's the smartest person in the room, that she's got everybody fooled, and that she's got everybody figured out. And Joe is going to show that he's the one who really has it figured out. He's figured her out. And ultimately, he's going to be upstaged by the fact that Dottie has sort of taken control of the situation through a twist of fate. This was McConaughey's best scene for me, actually. This sort of interplay he has with Gershon. You know, it seems like both he and Gershon have gotten shit for their acting, or for their, you know, I mean, being in certain movies. She was in Showgirls, I think, and But I think this, you know, she's never been afraid to look trashy. And she's never been afraid to look unflattering. You know, the way she's kind of sucking her fingers here and, you know, munching that food. I mean, it seems like any actress who did this part would have had to jump in whole hog. You know, you're not going to do this part and only go halfway. Now, this slow reveal, Joe kind of toying with them the way a Bond villain would kind of, you know, become all of a sudden very, very verbal at a key point in the story. I think it's very well realized from sort of script to screen by the way Friedkin stages all this. You know, once again, you know, and we're in a trailer, we're in a confined space. So, again, it's a nice trailer, but we have to have the sense that we're in a confined space. And so the camera angles and the way he's sort of pulling in on the two shot of, Joe and Gershon, like in this shot, really, we have that claustrophobia kind of, that light in between them in the background, sort of, kind of a foreboding light that suggests where Dottie is or where she resides, that room of hers back there, sort of as the thing hanging between them. Yeah, what struck me about the production design is that this is almost too nice a place. Like, you wouldn't think that their trailer would look this nice. Yeah. So this is where you see that this was based on a play. That and Friedkin kind of accepts that and just has this camera sort of glide left to right a little bit. Probably staged the way it would be staged, you know, in this camera angle, where the audience is now. Now, this whole math thing, this whole arithmetic that gets done at the end of the movie here is the audience I saw it with found this wildly funny. And Gina Gershon, I think, is very realistic here. Here's where McConaughey actually starts to ham it a little bit, or starts to slice into the ham, you might say. But he never goes too much. It's always exactly what, you know, Joe Cooper would do, how he would behave. I even like the way they slicked McConaughey's hair to make it look darker than we know it actually is. And of course, you heard there on the television before he smashes that plasma television or whatever it is, that they were starting a George Raft marathon. George Raft, of course, the great Warner Brothers property of the 1930s and 40s, the great, he sort of went out of, didn't get as many parts in movies as soon as sort of Bogart got big. Bogart and Cagney kind of upstage Raft, but Raft still was making, I mean, Raft would play, if this were a movie made by Warner Brothers in the 30s, Raft would play the Joe, the Killer Joe role. Certainly wouldn't play Thomas Hayden Church. Raft kind of had one speed, George Raft, and that was the tough guy. The takes no guff guy. He rarely played something other than that. Now this catching someone in a lie is I enjoy the Killer Joe character, because this idea of catching someone in a lie in this way, he's sort of half being the detective he is as a police officer, and he's kind of half being the sadistic, and he's being emotionally sadistic here, and he'll be violently sadistic in a moment. I like how he seemed to have those pictures in his ass. That's a great movie. Maybe that had to do with the NC-17. Now this whole "whose dick is that" thing is funny. The this was the biggest laugh in the movie when I saw it with an audience. Just kind of ho hum. No, and it's really kind of sad how she says you were drunk. You know. That was really, I alluded to it a moment ago, that was really what was interesting to me about this whole sequence here at the end. You see how Joe sits next to him, showing him the photographs, going over the evidence, as it were, functioning as a police officer would. He says, now take a good look at this picture, son. You might be drunk. You know, that's something a police officer would say in talking to a witness or something. So he's piecing together the mystery here. He's figuring it out, and he's using those police skills, but also using his skills as a sadistic killer and a person who hurts people for his own benefit. I just find that very, 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 very kind of enjoyable about the character. This is not a one-dimensional character, you know. There's a lot of psychology going on to Joe, and a character this intelligent is not pure evil as a character. You know, it's a character who's fucked up and who's psychologically ill. more than, you know, because characters who are pure evil just aren't interesting. their motives just aren't as interesting as a character like this, who is sort of doing good deeds and bad deeds at the same time, sort of helping people and hurting people at the same time, in a sense. You know, there's a sense in which that's true about Joe, and I just find that to be really nice. Before Billy, that blood all over her face is immediately when she's punched is something that is not as realistic, but it gets across that this, you know, the whole idea of the blood being all over the place and that we see blood and that this whole room is going to turn bloody is a big part of this, the point here. Now here comes, I haven't even thought about, when I was preparing to do this, I haven't even thought about what I would say regarding this chicken scene. I mean, what do you say while, gives head to a drumstick, a chicken, a piece of chicken? Now that sort of, you made your bed line, I mean, from the stage, as a line written in a stage play, it sort of has that wonderfully, the double meaning or the wonderful connotations of it, sort of like, Eugene O'Neill would do, you made your bed, but she also made her bed by going to bed with someone, you know, it's very... And we're being reminded here of the previous sex scene with Joe that took place in this kitchen. That's even a little poetic thing there with Thomas Hayden Church. He said, "What do you think?" He throws up and he says, "I don't." Well, indeed, that character doesn't think very much. Another noir, it occurs to me here, now this certainly, giving head to fried chicken, is not a film noir trope. Do you like that one? In case there was some controversy about whether giving head to pieces of chicken is a film noir trope. But the idea of a man like Killer Joe, a dangerous man, coming into and mixing... in film noir, he would be, his world would collide and he would become mixed up in the affairs of good people or honest people or quote unquote normal people. Here he's coming into contact with people who are already kind of fucked up and gnarly. Now here's McConaughey. This is really, asking her to please moan, and the sort of perverted sexual faces that he's making now. I don't even know how to fucking describe it, but because obviously he's not actually getting head. He's got a piece of chicken in her mouth, but it's this idea that this isn't, like I said before about Killer Joe, this isn't an act. This guy is really messed up. And apparently when they did do stage productions, that this was even, and on stage it would be even more disturbing. I mean, here's something that I could do without, that little bit of, that little moment there with Juno Temple on the bed, saying, it's suffocating me, and she had another line there. When you get to the end of the movie, you say, was that necessary? How did that move the ball down the field? Was that narratively necessary? Do we need that to get that character any more than we have her? I think if we just cut to her and see that she's there and see that she's just sort of, on the bed chilling out is enough. This is what I mean by Gina Gershon being, being very, very good here. Do you think she's beautiful? I haven't given it much thought, you know. I think the hardest person playing this scene is Thomas Hayden Church, because he just has to kind of be this dim-witted guy who's witnessing this, and, you know, and we see how much fear Killer Joe has stricken into the hearts of these people. This is what I mean, the sort of underplot, or the plot that Joe just figured out, that she was running around on Ansel, and that this was all a scheme to get Chris to whack Adele, the mother and ex-wife of Thomas Hayden Church. This was all a scheme to get Chris to do that for Rex, so that he could enjoy the money with Sharla. That does, as like I said, that doesn't matter as much as the storyline, the plot between. That is a functional kind of plot about materialistic motives. That hasn't as much interest to it, as far as I'm concerned, as the emotional stakes and the emotional things going on in this kitchen right now, in that kitchen right now, between Joe, Dottie, Gina Gershon getting her comeuppance, and, you know, the way these emotions sort of swell here is far more interesting than that. That's a pure MacGuffin plot. You know, it just allows us to learn about the characters so that we can really be affected by the emotional stuff here. And the kind of I like the way, when I first saw the movie with that audience. Yeah, Gina Gershon's very good here. Look at that. She plays frightened out of her mind very well. The first time I saw the movie with that audience, I really noticed the way those jokes, Thomas Hayden Church's lines, and there'll even be another couple jokes in the movie. I really appreciated the way those jokes affected the audience, because it didn't undermine the drama of the scene. It didn't make it any less harrowing, and it didn't let us off the hook in terms of, you know, if this were just a complete farce and a comedy, then there would be no reality to the stakes. We wouldn't, you know, the Emil Hirsch character, we wouldn't care about what he feels for Dottie too. We wouldn't care about Dottie if it were just pure farce. We wouldn't care in the same way. But here, I think the jokes, the way Tracy Letts has written this, the jokes kind of pop up, and ha-ha, it's funny, and then it's right back to Joe beating the shit out of her and making him suck his chicken drumstick dick. Now, here's where Juno Temple really drives home how smart her performance is and how smart the character is, because she's Miss Oblivious, right? She's pretending to be almost blinded by the affection Joe has for her and her affection for him. You see her face there. I mean, she's not pretending, but there's a part of her that perhaps is, but there is also a part of her that is manipulating all these people, and probably manipulating Chris too. That's another dimensionary character that I've thought about, to Juno Temple's character, Dottie, is, you know, this whole affection thing with her and her brother Chris, and she seems to reciprocate. She seems to, now I don't doubt that she cares, but to the extent that, I mean, to what extent is she playing this up? Is she, feigning more reciprocation for her brother than she has in order to manipulate him, or at least in order to keep him close, because she does like him, having him around, and in a perfectly, you know, normal way, like liking that in a perfectly normal way. I mean, I like how we can choose our own adventure. We can answer these things for ourselves, because the performance is so textured. Now she's at her most childlike here, even while Sharla has a face full of blood, and you know, it's funny how the character, how two of the characters look like they've gone 12 rounds with Jack Johnson, you know. and the other two don't seem to care. I mean, one thing I always think of is, in movies like this where you have such weird things happening. What if someone came so late to the movie, you know, they missed everything up to this point. They just sat down in the theater and this was going on. You know, you've got Matthew McConaughey presiding over this dinner. Now that was a good little joke there. The Thomas Hayden Church, trying to propose or trying to take part in that toast. This whole, you know, maybe it's because Tracy Letts is a, now, and I like how you think this is going one way with Chris kind of taking over the movie, but it kind of goes the other direction. Oh, what I was going to say, maybe it's because Tracy Letts is a playwright, but I really like how this movie kind of reminds me of a couple different Shakespeare plays. There's a play called Measure for Measure in which a man is, I believe, in jail, and they come up with the idea. Yeah, he's in jail. They come up with the idea that they'll put up the guy's sister, who is a nun, in order to, she'll basically, the jurist who has imprisoned her brother, he says, well, if your sister has sex with me, or he propositions the sister, he says, you know, we'll let your brother go if you fuck me. And it's sort of this sex or women or someone's sister being offered up as, payment for the sins of the brother or a family member is. I think there's a couple different examples of that in Shakespeare. I can't think of the other one, but for some reason I know it's there. Now that's a good line from Juno Temple. I'm getting angry. Yeah, that was unexpected when I saw the movie when she shot Chris. So the power dynamic that's been reversed here. It's a great ending because you don't need to see him shot. But I like the power dynamic that has been reversed there. It's been reversed on the surface, right? The actual power dynamic is that she's kind of been, to some extent, you know, wielding her power in her own sort of covert way. as a character, she's sort of been doing that the whole time. So it's just now, it's a question of who has the power, who has the gun at the end. I hope you enjoyed watching this weird, wild movie with me. I also hope that this will not be the final Billy Friedkin movie that I do. I really like him as a director. I've always liked him as a presence in movies as well. And I hope to do some more pictures by him. And perhaps I hope to do some McConaughey pictures too. I haven't done, of all the commentaries we've done so far, I haven't done any sort of the older classic movies, the old, none of my Warner Brothers movies from the 30s, and a lot of the movies that I sometimes reference in these commentaries. So I need to do some older ones too. But Billy Friedkin, it was so nice to see him doing something so wild and so well crafted at his age. It's encouraging, very encouraging. At any rate, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.